podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Professor John Lim has devoted his professional life to bringing better healthcare to patients in Southeast Asia by improving the joint practice of clinical research and regulatory science. He is founding executive director of the Duke National University of Singapore Center of Regulatory Excellence, or CORE. He is also chairman of the Singapore Clinical Research Institute and the National Health Innovation Center. Furthermore, he is the senior advisor to the Singapore Ministry of Health and formerly served as chief executive officer of Singapore's Health Sciences Authority, HSA. In 2018, Professor Lim received DIA's Global Connector Inspire Award for all of his efforts. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. Professor Lim joins me today to discuss clinical research and regulatory science in Asia Pacific. John, thank you very much for being with us and welcome.
Thank you, Alberto. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Let me start with a question relating to ICH. Singapore has joined ICH. Has this been of benefit to regulators and regulatory science in Singapore specifically already?
Well, Alberto, I think it definitely is of benefit. It's not new in a sense because the Singapore Health Science Authority, or HSA, has been an observer in the ICH Global Cooperation Group for many years. So in fact, officers and colleagues from HSA have been very actively involved. And so in a sense, this was an honor, but also a natural progression in terms of the relationship between Singapore and ICH. Clearly, there is benefit because I think in addition to being part of the discussions of what goes on in terms of standards and guidances and harmonization, I think Singapore and HSA would now be able to contribute specifically in terms of contributing to the thoughts and issues in a more involved way. It's also helpful, I think, even from where I am now, although I'm no longer with HSA, but I'm with CORE, as you've described, because we are also supporting ICH as a training center. So just in fact, about 3 weeks ago, we held a workshop on chemistry, manufacturing, and controls, which was recognized as part of the ICH training. And we look forward to working closely with ICH in terms of capacity building going forward. So I think on the whole, it's a very positive thing. And we look forward to how we can really support global extension of ICH standards and certainly in terms of strengthening the use of ICH guidelines.
In relation to joining ICH, of course, ICH has produced more than 60 guidelines over the years. Has HSA in Singapore basically adopted all of these guidelines as a body of work?
Yes, HSA has been using this very stringently and robustly. Of course, where we are in the region, we are in a sense a kind of bridge between East and West. And so we're exposed to a whole range of standards and guidelines, but ICH is the kind of gold standard which HSA has been using. So even in terms of the templates that have been used, while there is a kind of ASEAN dossier as well as technical requirements, Singapore has always taken the position that we're able to accept everything else that comes in terms of what is required even by ICH. So the Singapore authority has always been very well plugged into the international scene, and I think over the years has achieved a high standard and recognition for its scientific robustness. So certainly the ICH guidelines have been a key part of the way in which HSA has looked at regulation and standards.
If I could ask you a question about a little anomaly, and that is the ICH Common Technical Document has 5 modules, but the ASEAN Common Technical Document has 4 modules. What is the future of the ASEAN CTD? Will it become 5 modules per ICH, or will it stay at 4 modules?
Well, I'm not part of that discussion, but in fact, this question was raised during the CMC workshop a few weeks ago. There is a certain history to this, because when the ASEAN Pharmaceutical Product Working Group was looking at defining and creating a dossier for Southeast Asia, they were in fact a little ahead of ICH in terms of coming together with the harmonized dossier. And so by the time ASEAN had introduced this, it was already part and parcel of the scene in this region. And the ICH CTD came in a little after that. So I think there was already a sense amongst the regulators in the region that that had already become part of what the regulatory scene in the region was. And looking at the substance of it, even though the structure was a bit different, there wasn't much difference. So of course, I think from the company's point of view, that does pose an issue because it would require some extra administrative inputs in terms of adjusting it. So Singapore has taken the pragmatic approach that whatever form the dossier comes into HSA, it would be accepted. So if it comes in an ICHCTD, there is no requirement to convert it to an ASEAN document, but in line with regional solidarity, if it comes in an ASEAN CTD format, then HSA would be able to take that too. So from the point of the regulator, essentially the substance is there, and HSA would be able to take whatever form it comes in and use that as the basis for the assessment. I think in terms of the region, my sense is probably because it's already, the ASEAN CTD is already so much part and parcel of the scene here, it would be difficult to sort of just drop it, because I think there is a kind of sense that this forms something significant in terms of the region. And because the sense is that the substance is essentially similar, if depending whatever form it is, if more and more regulators are following what HSA is doing, then I think there wouldn't be much of an issue really. And you wouldn't have to go into the thorny problem of, are you going to drop one format vis-a-vis another?
Right. So from a practical point of view, if one is a pharmaceutical sponsor, would it make sense to check with an individual authority within the ASEAN region before submitting a CTD to ask whether a 5-module CTD per ICH would be acceptable to that particular authority before submitting it? Would that be a reasonable approach?
Yes, it is always good practice, Alberto. I mean, for any sponsor to speak to the regulatory authority first. And my understanding is increasingly more and more of the authorities in the region do have pre-submission opportunities for sponsors to clarify what the requirements are. And increasingly, I think this would solve some of the administrative issues, at least, that the companies are facing.
Thank you. Let me move to another topic relating to the recent DIA Core Singapore annual meeting that featured a number of sessions devoted to technology in healthcare, a very hot topic globally, of course. So I wanted to ask you, has artificial intelligence impacted clinical research and regulatory science in Singapore in any way so far?
Well, clearly there's no part of the world that is not impacted by AI or artificial intelligence. I think I would say it's still developing in Singapore. Clearly there's a great deal of interest in terms of what artificial intelligence brings to the table. There are various initiatives that are beginning in some areas like ophthalmology and even, I understand, in emergency medicine, where when it comes to research there, they're looking at AI as a potential to promote research and actually then be adapted and adopted into healthcare systems along the way. So, of course, within the Singapore system, the IT background and infrastructure is extremely strong. But I think because there are regulatory issues in terms of data governance, how you would then use AI, concerns about validity and how this would apply. And because this is all pretty new, I think this is where the field is developing fast. And that's why, in fact, it was a key topic at the recent DIA Singapore meeting. So we had very interesting sort of examples that were shared. There was Dr. Zakaria from Malaysia who spoke about artificial intelligence and medical epidemiology there. And he was talking about using AI to drive public health in the area of dengue surveillance in one of the states in Malaysia. So that was an interesting example. But when I think it comes to research, it's fast developing. What we are also trying to do, at least from CORE's perspective, is to better define not just AI, but in the whole area of digital health, what are the specific issues? Because as I've spoken to some individuals and companies, the sense is, when one talks of digital health, AI, real-world evidence, all these kind of buzzwords, there's a lot of hype about them. What we're trying to do is potentially organize a roundtable or two to clarify what exactly we're talking about. There's no shortage of conferences and meetings talking about digital health these days in Singapore particularly, and I'm sure around the region as well. But what we would really like to do is clarify what exactly are we addressing, whether it's in terms of research or regulation. But specifically then, when we're defining this, as we go a bit deeper, what are the specific regulatory concerns? So I think even if one is talking about AI and sort of self-learning and the algorithms keep developing, obviously there are public concerns because people are not totally aware of where this is leading. And of course, in the realm of science fiction, again, there has been no shortage of novels and films over the years about how AI can go in untoward directions. And I think we need to sort of go beyond the kind of fantasy to reality and work out what exactly science offers. And so I think this is an area that we are particularly interested in studying further. And I'm sure DIA also has a lot of interest in this area. And I think these are things we need to settle because, as I said, there's a lot of hype. What is the reality? What are the critical issues that we need to look at in terms of regulation? And then because there are various areas that even go into the realms of ethics, the whole area of regulatory science needs to evolve to address these. So I think that, to me, is where we are at this point in time.
I'm wondering if we are now in a time where we're going past the question of what is artificial intelligence and getting into the question of how do we use it to generate actionable evidence in clinical research.
Yeah, this is absolutely true. So that really is where we're trying to move beyond hype to reality. And the issue of algorithms, of course, when it comes to AI is the thing that people need to understand more about. I mean, one critical area, I think, when you look at healthcare systems is the issue of optimizing clinical and operational effectiveness. So this is an area, I think, where research in AI is developing to really inform and aid decision-making by not only physicians, but also then operational decisions by healthcare providers. Then, of course, the technology linked with AI, when you're talking of merging machine learning capabilities to increase efficiency for things like clinical diagnosis, anatomic reviews, predictive modeling, these are issues, I think, which are obviously very exciting and they offer a lot of opportunities. Now, I think it's an issue of figuring out how these can be used well, how they can be used, they can be spread. But I think fundamentally, you still have to address this issue of perception of the providers, the professionals, and the public. And I think this has to be dealt with. And this is where regulatory science comes into the picture to help clarify the issues. So it comes back to my point that greater understanding and clarity in discussing these among stakeholders is important to really enable AI to be optimized.
It seems from your comments that Singapore really is engaged in a global conversation around AI, but more broadly technology and its impact on healthcare. Singapore is a very small country, but it seems to have quite a reach in terms of participating in global conversations. Is that fair enough?
I think it is true because Singapore is in a unique position. We're a small city state, but I think because of the rapid development over the last 50 over years and the fact that I think we do have a very credible and rational approach to both science, regulation, healthcare systems, makes us a very good sort of hub to bring thought leaders, practitioners together to look at these issues. And I think especially in an area like this, which is linked to digital health, and because Singapore has a national program called the Smart Nation Initiative, which is looking at the greater use of IT across systems, and that's driven by a number of factors, including the need to be more efficient, the fact that we are more resource constrained, the fact that expertise needs to be focused in specific areas. So I think we have for many years now been a place where people feel comfortable coming together. And there is a sense that it's not just a talk shop, but we're also looking for solutions. And these are solutions based in what we understand, the sense of reality to it. But it's also very sound and looking at where technology is not only now available today, but we're always very forward looking in terms of how it can be applied in the future. So I think that's why Singapore has become a center for such discussions.
Well, it seems that the relatively small sizes of Singapore is actually an advantage more than a disadvantage. It feels like Singapore is almost a living laboratory with a very appropriate human scale where innovations can be tested rather rapidly, more rapidly than might be the case in a much larger, more complex country.
Well, Singapore has always been supportive of innovation. However, I think it's a very sensitive issue when you talk about a kind of living laboratory because we're talking of our population and people, patients. So it's not always true in a sense that simply because we're promoting an innovation, we would therefore just be so gung-ho in terms of pushing forward in either trialing something or piloting something. So we would still assess benefit risk. We would still have to assess what is the impact, what's the state of knowledge. Sometimes we assess that it's better that we see how it's developed and matured in other settings, and then we can adapt it into our setting. So I think we should not go away with the sense that even though Singapore is very innovation supportive and a lot of things can be tested and piloted here, that we would be irresponsible in a sense in terms of what we follow through when it comes to the kind of context that you're talking about.
Oh, indeed. I was not suggesting that there are any shortcuts being taken there. Not at all. In fact, I wanted to ask you, with respect to clinical research, are there any particular therapeutic areas of special interest in Singapore?
Well, the National Medical Research Council, which is part of the Ministry of Health, has identified sort of five key areas for research. These were enunciated several years ago. So oncology is a major area, cardiovascular diseases. The third one would be diabetes and metabolic disorders. This third one is particularly significant because the Ministry of Health has declared what is called a war on diabetes, because it was found that because of our developed sort of lifestyle these days, even though we are developing in other aspects, I think non-communicable diseases, especially in terms of diabetes, has been an issue of significant concern. So there's been a major initiative to promote research in this area and also look at proper therapies, as well as sort of broader health systems, health promotion issues. The fourth area would be infectious diseases, because while malaria is not a significant issue within Singapore, dengue is. And so these are concerns in terms of tropical infectious diseases. And the last area that was identified was neurological and sense disorders. So these were broadly defined in terms of issues of priority for the country. But also, as you can see from these things, they're also determined by the fact that Singapore's population is rapidly aging. So anything in terms of clinical research that looks into healthier aging, as it were, and sort of improving quality of life, lowering the incidence of chronic diseases, these are issues, I think, that are significant and have been defined as priorities in terms of the clinical research scene in Singapore.
That makes a lot of sense. It tempts me to ask you about rare diseases and whether these are in any way a focus in Singapore, given the small population. Are orphan diseases an area of focus at all?
It's not a primary area of focus, partly, as you say, because the population is small. But as you probably know, across APEC, there is a significant emphasis on rare diseases. There is an APEC Rare Disease Network, which has been set up quite recently. And in fact, there is a very good document that has been just released not long ago, which is accessible, I think, through the APEC website. So in terms of rare diseases and research, it would be difficult for Singapore alone to be looking at that simply because of the small size of the population. But I think if you look at a regional level, this does seem to be a developing area. And again, it's something that we in CORE are beginning to look at more, partly because of our links with the APEC region and the rare disease network that I mentioned. And also, we have begun a conversation with Faster Cures as well, see whether we can also discuss with them issues of patient engagement. And one of the areas then would be rare diseases. But of course, I think as you're familiar, this issue is a difficult one because of the vast number of rare diseases. And so I think in terms of dealing with the specific diseases and also the companies that are currently interested in this area, there's a lot of opportunity, but I think the needs in a sense outweigh where the resources can be focused. And a bit of the problem really is deciding where we are focusing our discussions and efforts there. The other related issue, of course, is that whenever therapies for rare diseases do come forward, there is a tendency for a very high cost. So I think the issue then of affordability and how these are funded comes into play. And again, this is an issue which is being looked at across the region. There's no easy solution to it. There are potential models. And I think this is something that requires further discussion as well.
In relation to the development of orphan drugs, for example, is the region considering or does it have in place any incentives for pharmaceutical sponsors to take advantage of when considering the development of orphan drugs? Tax incentives, for example.
I'm not aware that there is a kind of consistent position on this in the different countries. So while, for example, if you look at the Singapore regulations, they have supported a kind of fast track for orphan drugs, but I'm not aware that any have come through the system, at least locally. And certainly when it comes to financing, tax incentives, I'm not aware that there is a kind of consistent position across the region. I might be wrong on this, but there doesn't seem to me to be at least a coordinated initiative as yet for specific examples like this, largely because the healthcare systems, even if you look at the 10 member states of Southeast Asia, are quite different, and even the funding models and approaches are a little different. So it's often said that the Singapore healthcare system is extremely efficient and effective, but the way it runs and is supported is quite different if you look at it in the context of other countries. So I think each country has its own system. And when you're thinking of healthcare systems, healthcare financing, again, this is an area which is developing and requires further study. So certainly, I think as we in CORE are working with the Duke Margolis Center for Health Policy, this is an area that is of interest to us as well as we work with Mark McClellan and his team.
Indeed, and of course, that topic is not only hot in the Asia-Pacific region, but all over the world. Finally, John, let me ask you kind of a curiosity. Singapore is nearly 11,000 kilometers away from London. Yet in March of 2019, Duke and US CORE organized a symposium about Brexit and Asia-Pacific. So what is Brexit's potential impact on this region?
Well, I think it's not just on this region, although it seems to be an issue between the UK and the EU. Clearly, I think Brexit has potential to impact a lot of other areas around the world. We wanted to just bring to the stage, as it were, a legal perspective as well as a multinational company perspective on what Brexit meant for these two areas. I think at the end of the day, the sense was that there is a great deal of uncertainty. The likely impact in the Asia Pacific may not be as great, certainly, as it might be in Europe or in the UK, depending on what happens, since it's still so uncertain at this point in time. But it seems, at least from companies' points of view, they've already made the decision not to wait for the uncertainties, and they've certainly addressed a lot of the concerns up front in terms of how they have relocated some of their operations to other countries already, so that whatever happens at the end of the day, companies would not be affected. So I think really the end of that discussion concluded that as far as this part of the world is concerned, the impact might not be severe, but clearly there would be knock-on effects and ripple effects, depending on what happens, especially if there was a no-deal Brexit that happened. But from what we can see, everyone is desperately working to prevent that happening. But I think the jury is out, because even while we had that session in March, I mean, as of today, there is still no clarity what the next step is. So I think we're all waiting and watching.
Well, these are all my questions, John. I appreciate you joining me today and sharing your insights.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you, Alberto, and I look forward to keeping in touch. Thank you so much.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.